welcome to another episode of the Last Post Radio Show podcast series. You can download at any time and listen to anywhere. And in keeping with our, I guess, our philosophy to have some great guests on the radio show, today it is my great pleasure to introduce Graham Buzz Bidstrup. And Buzz, as he's known to friends, how are you, Graham?
I'm good, thank you, Greg. Hello, everyone. Lovely to be on the show.
Thank you so much for being here with us too, Buzz. You've got an amazing story. You've got your own story to tell as a musician and writer. You've got, of course, your big work with the Thumbs Up Foundation and the Jimmy Little Foundation, exemplifying good tucker, long life. Can you tell us, Graham, a little bit about Jimmy Little and how this all came into being?
Look, I was obviously my career has been in as a musician and record producer in different bands and stuff. And then in 1999, I was approached by the singer of Gangajang, Mark Callahan, who was working at Festival Records. And he had heard a new record by Jimmy Little called Messenger. Mm-hmm. And he wondered whether they were looking for someone to basically, you know, look after the record when it came out, meaning do some publicity stuff, and maybe if Jimmy needed any gigs to find some gigs for him and that sort of stuff. And I think the record company were under the impression, and it wasn't Mark, but the record company were under the impression that it would sell a couple of thousand records and Jimmy would play a couple of gigs at his old haunts, you know, the RSL clubs and stuff, and that'd be it. Well, in actual fact, it turned out that Triple J picked up that record and introduced Jimmy Little, who was then 62, to a completely new audience, or, you know, a Triple J audience, 18 to 30. That then catapulted Jimmy into this situation where me, as his representative at the time, being basically an agent more than anything, I was fielding calls from the Livid Festival and the, you know, Sydney Festival and WOMAD, and all these people wanted Jimmy Little to come and play at their groovy festival or their gig. And most of them wanted a band. So Jimmy said to me, oh, Mark said that you know how to put a band together and, you know, you're a manager and all that sort of stuff. And I'd just come out of a fairly bad, or not bad, but, you know, a management situation with a girl called Diana Arnade that I'd spent a couple of years building her career, and then it's a long story, but it sort of fell apart. So I didn't really want to manage anyone, but I said to Jimmy, look, I'll help you get some gigs and I'll put a band together for you and I'll find you another manager. How's that? Mm. And he said, oh, that'd be fine. And we shook hands, and 13 years later, I was still his manager. Yeah, so it's a pretty wild sort of story. And that's how I got to be his manager. Mm. And then that brought in all of the other stuff with the foundations, you know.
Yeah, so I guess thanks to Mark from Gangajang for perhaps pointing you in that direction, Graham.
Absolutely. Look, I can say, and I do say to him, you know, it changed my life, the whole situation and meeting Jimmy. I mean, I had a small amount of knowledge about Indigenous Australia that I picked up through, you know, hanging out with people like Yothu Indy and Warrumpi Band. And, you know, I sort of knew a little bit about, you know, I knew about the 67 referendum and other bits and pieces, but I'd never immersed myself in Indigenous culture until I started managing Jimmy. And of course, his new fame, you know, his reignited fame meant that everybody wanted a piece of Jimmy Little. You know, I remember we talked way back, you know, everyone from the government wanted him to be a spokesman for Indigenous literacy and numeracy and go around to schools talking to kids. Mm. You know, community organisations wanted Jimmy to come and visit and sing at NAIDOC events or whatever. So I found myself sitting in a hire car with Jimmy quite often, you know, say driving around, you know, in the outback or up in Darwin or, you know, at Uluru or wherever it might have been. And as we would come into a community, Jimmy would be greeted by the elders of the community, many who he had known, you know, in the old days, because Jimmy had been travelling out there since the 60s, you know, since he had his his hit record in 64. So, you know, the elders would come out, and Jimmy, in his beautiful way, would just turn to them and say, "Oh, this is my friend Buzz." Right? Not this is my manager, or this is someone who's working with me. Just say, "Here's my friend Buzz."
It
And that
must have been
immediately meant.
a close relationship, Graham, for you and for Jimmy to be driving, because driving is a great way of getting to know someone.
Absolutely. And as I pointed out in my book, which I'm sure we'll talk about, my upcoming book, you know, we could drive, say, from Alice Springs to Uluru, which would be 4 hours, 5 hours, and barely say a word to each other, or we could talk for the entire way. It sort of depended on, I guess, what mood both of us were in, I sort of say that to say that we could communicate without even talking,
That's great.
and
And you would feel comfortable about that too, Buzz, because I guess with people that you know well, or at least you connect with, there is sometimes no need to talk.
that's right, you know, and you could, you might be, I don't know, you know, something like, "Oh, it looks dry," or it looks green, it's been raining. And then he might say something like that, and then you sort of, you look at it and you take it in, and then, a bit later on, you might say, "Yeah, I wonder, I wonder if the wildlife sort of come back, or if there's any wildflowers or something." And then nobody say anything for a while. But yeah, it's just one of those things about being comfortable with each other, and communicating when you needed to. Sometimes Jim liked to sort of retreat into, I say into himself, but sort of just retreat and relax and chill out. And he could do that anywhere. You know, he could do that in an airport lounge, or he could do it backstage, or wherever he needed to just retreat and gather his thoughts. It's a beautiful thing that he taught me, just how to kind of relax and take things in, and not get too, worried about anything. Jimmy was a, yeah,
Well,
yeah, he was a.
that's certainly a message that in today's society that we could heed with great respect, the ability to disengage and become less stressed about things that perhaps in the end don't really matter, Buzz.
Yeah, I think that's a definite thing. He had definite opinions on certain things, and the more I got to know him, the more he would share those with me. And his faith was a big part of that. He was a Christian man. He was a believer, but he didn't adhere to any particular brand of religion, which frustrated a lot of people, because all the different religions were trying to
Jimmy
grab
Little.
hold of grab hold of them, and sort of say, "Oh, Jimmy's one of us," whereas Jimmy was one of them, but not a particular one,
Yes, I understand completely, and I guess maybe a lot of people may feel that way too. If we speak of Jimmy Little, I guess the added bonus for Buzz Bidstrup was to actually find some connection with Bush Tucker and the health benefits amongst Indigenous people, because we know the health figures are not good for Indigenous people, Graham. What was
Yeah.
your, I mean, tell us a little bit about Bush Tucker and how that can help. And I mean, you do a lot of programs too, with healthy
Yeah.
recipes and teaching. What's it all involve?
Well, look, it's basically, again, it came out of these visits that I did with Jimmy in early 2000. So the first community I went to was Mutitjulu, and that was at the one on the other side of the rock, other side of Uluru. It used to be the car park and caravan park, but it's now a community. It's now the Indigenous community. Now, the first time I went there, I looked around and I was fairly shocked at, I guess, looking at the older buildings. And there were people I met where there were 10 people living in a 2-bedroom house, and we'd sort of talk to the people. The service providers, say the health people. Jimmy at the time, to start with, was quite healthy, in the sense he didn't tell me that he'd been told that his kidneys were a little bit suspect. I didn't find that out until about 2002 or 2003, when his kidneys actually failed. But to start off with, we would talk to the health people and find out that the actual state of health within those communities, quite a lot of them, in fact, most of them, I would say, was well below par, well below what it should have been. I guess the pretty much everyone was battling through, not enough funding for particular health programs. One of the things that was really apparent way back then was the incidence of diabetes, which was growing. This is way back. This is 20, 2002, 2001, and the incidence of diabetes, and also the age that Indigenous people were contracting diabetes was getting lower and lower. And we started to talk with people within the community in Alice Springs. There's a wonderful organization called the Purple House, who basically are connected to the Kintore community, which is out near the West Australian border, sort of straight west from Alice Springs. And that was actually the community where the last nomads walked out of the desert in 1984, around there, Kirikara. They were called Pintabi Nine. So that community, we went out to that community for an event and found out that they had many of the very famous dot painters out there, and they'd sold some paintings, bought a dialysis unit, bought a house in Alice Springs, put a dialysis unit in it, and were showing residents how to use the dialysis machine. Because in those remote communities, if somebody had, kidney failure and needed dialysis, they had to travel into Alice Springs, meaning they left their home, they left their family, they left their country, and they basically left all hope. And many people left communities to go to Alice Springs to dialyse and never came back, because they would just get very sick. And to undergo dialysis, you need to go, have heart doctors, basically everything has to be checked when you're doing dialysis. So we started working with them to advocate to the then Howard government for dialysis units and dialysis facilities in some major remote communities, and that was not on their agenda at all. That government wanted were hubs like Alice Springs, Darwin, Kalgoorlie, and Port Augusta were the main hubs of dialysis. So anyone that got dialysis in any part of, basically, that the western northern part of Australia would be sent to a hub. And so we started working on how we could do something about that, and we raised enough money. We were given a grant by Medicines Australia, and we used $500,000 to have a truck built. It's called the Purple Truck, and it operates out of Alice Springs. It's operated by the Purple House, and they take people out to community back home from Alice Springs, and they can stay there for a week or so with the truck, and they can dialyse in the truck and reconnect to their community, then go back to Alice Springs.
How wonderful. How
That it's
wonderful.
fantastic. And
Yeah. The purple truck.
it was built by it's a truck built by a company in Adelaide, and it was designed by the Purple House, built by this crew in Adelaide. And our plan was to try and get 20 of these trucks built. So that was 10 million bucks that we needed, and we set about trying to put events together. We were going to have one big event at Uluru. We had all of the permissions in place except from Parks Australia, and they at the last minute didn't agree to us putting people in buses, driving them through the park to the community, holding a concert, and then driving them back again. For some silly reason, we weren't allowed to do that, and I had a lot of people clued up, ready to do that, teed up, ready to do that concert. Very famous people, but so when we were thinking about, okay, what can we do to help move this forward, the Howard government brought down the intervention, and that changed the game incredibly. I remember sitting again in Mutitjulu, and watching women go to the school, grab their kids, and run into the desert.
Oh, go.
Because they figured that when the people, the army came to do these so-called checks for sexual, they said that there was a whole network, in these communities of sexual predators, which was based on a lie. It was based on a false story on the ABC, which has been proved, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah,
So
so
they may have
once
felt
the
the
intervention happened.
indigenous people may have felt that this was a return back to the future with their children being taken away from them.
Yeah, we were stolen, another stolen generation, basically. That's kind of how it was being looked on. And so we had a bit of a think. The Jimmy Little Foundation was formed basically as an advocacy organization. And we had three wonderful trustees. We had Jeff McMullen, the journalist. We had a wonderful Indigenous doctor, Dr. Brad Murphy, who's up in Bundaberg. And the third one was the Reverend John McIntyre, who was the Archbishop of Gippsland. Unfortunately, he passed away. But those three men were instrumental in helping me plot a course for the Jimmy Little Foundation
Oh, okay.
to do this advocacy. Then when we had a brainwave one day, I was up at the Garma Festival with Jimmy. He'd been invited to go up there and sing, and I was obviously doing what I could to meet up with people and advocate and do whatever, you know. A lot of my job was meeting the right people, you know, who I could talk to about different things. And I said to Jimmy, wouldn't it be nice if there were some products? Because we'd go to some stores, and the only thing people could buy in the takeaway were like these things, wingdings and fried food and you know, just crap basically. And I started talking with people about, well, to nutritionists, and I would go and meet the nutritionists in the remote communities and in Darwin and Alice Springs, and started talking to them about, so what, you know, what about if there was a healthy breakfast snack or something that the kids could have every day, like a, you know, a shake or something like that. And most of the nutritionists said to me, if you could get kids to eat more fruit and vegetables and drink more water and less sugar drink. So this is, you know, this is back in 2005, six. If you could do that, you would go a long way to sort of helping change the statistic of, you know, kids as young as 10 and 12 being diagnosed as pre-diabetic. So I went to the CEO of ALPA, which is Arnhem Progress Association, and they run stores in the remote communities, particularly in Arnhem Land. And because I'd been in Arnhem Land in Garma Festival, and I knew quite a few people by then who lived in different communities in Arnhem Land, we decided to work with ALPA and try and come up with just some signage, you know, and that's where the Good Tucker Long Life came from. And we worked with the Fred Hollows Foundation to use a cookbook called Cook 'em But Good One Daga, which is now on our website. It's available for free. You can download it for free. And, you know, we started working with nutritionists and just doing, I guess, basic education whenever we could. And then we got a massive grant from Medicines Australia again, and that enabled us to set up that program, the Thumbs Up program, which basically uses music and new media like video, computers and things. Because back then it was kind of right at the start of all of the social media stuff. So we started working on that. And that program has built through now to encompass other things that we've done with domestic, you know, violence awareness and things like fetal alcohol syndrome, FASD. And we do that by engaging with kids and young adults in communities, writing songs and making little videos with them to get them to be the ones sending the message. So they're the ones sending them to their communities.
It's
That's been really successful.
a great thing that you've been doing, and Graham, a great thing you've been doing, obviously, to establish with Jimmy and a lot of help from some generous Australians. Jimmy Little, we're talking about actor, musician, proud Yorta Yorta man, and we're talking about Jimmy's Thumbs Up
Yes.
Foundation and the Jimmy Little Foundation with Graham Buzz Bidstrup, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to take a short break.
You're listening to Greg T. Ross and the Last Post Radio Show on Captivate, Apple, and Spotify.
Welcome back to the Last Post Radio Show. And we've got the great privilege of talking to Graham Buzz Bidstrup, musician, writer, and proud worker with the Thumbs Up Foundation, the Jimmy Little Foundation. We've been talking about Graham's friendship with Jimmy and how it all got started. And I suppose, Buzz, finally, before we move on to your wonderful new book, the Jimmy Little Foundation, the purple truck, the purple house, the cookbook that you can download from the website, you've got some amazing things happening: health recipes, teaching, the Good Tucker app, music writing workshops. So you're really covering a lot of things.
Look, I think it all stems from the fact that we use music as the connector, as the thing, the driver that we use to engage, particularly kids, but most people in communities. I mean, most community members are either into sport or music, and if you can find something to engage people, then you can subtly, deliver little messages,
Yes, indeed,
and
indeed.
our message is very simple. Eat good food. Jimmy used to have a beautiful saying about, like, a car. If you put bad petrol into a car, it won't work. So why would you put bad petrol into your body?
Yeah,
Why would you
exactly.
put bad fuel into your
And
body? So
it's all about what you what you accept and what you allow to penetrate through to your psyche. And I guess the more good stuff out there, and credit to you and the Jimmy Little Foundation, Thumbs Up Foundation, for doing all this positive stuff, because of course it reminds people that there is assistance out there for a better life, and a lot of good people are working behind the scenes, Graham.
Look, and one thing I'd say is that after we got started with Arnhem Land Progress Association, I went to the other organisation that runs about 120 stores called Outback Stores, and I asked them the same question. I said, can we work with your nutritionists and get some signage in the stores, and work towards, some programs to deliver some preventative health messages into the stores, into the communities where your stores are? And they said yes. So, now we have a whole suite of signage that was designed with their nutritionist by us and the nutritionists. And there it's in, over 150 stores across the top end now. Things that work with the Good Tucker app, which is a very simple app that reads barcodes of food, and either depending on the health star rating of it and whether it's something that you need, a core food that you need for life, or a discretionary food that you don't actually need to sustain life, it'll give you a thumbs rating of, thumbs up if it's a good one, thumbs sideways if it's not so good, and thumbs down if it's one to avoid.
What a
So
marvelous idea.
that's all of the side of it. It's fantastic. And that was designed with a wonderful professor, Julie Brimblecombe, and Tom Winchley from Adelaide Uni, and Julie's from Monash. And they that that is a wonderful, wonderful tool that's sort of just part of the, I guess, the arsenal of things to try and help people to pick healthier food. And since we released that, I've had lots of discussions with Diabetes Australia. I work with them. I work in Western Sydney, with the Western Sydney Diabetes and the Western Sydney Local Health District, just because Western Sydney has actually got, more diabetes than anywhere else in Australia, I think. It's fairly out of control.
Yes,
Um,
yes.
so yeah, it's exploded, really. I mean, it could be a massive organization, I guess, if we wanted it to be. But it's kind of nice just being smaller and having specific things like the app, which are free. The app's free. So yeah, I guess it's just wonderful to be able to do something positive,
Yes,
and I
indeed.
know that it does something positive.
If there were more Australians like yourself, Graham, it would be a better society. It's a pretty good society if you dig deep enough now. But of course, our aim, obviously, through the radio show, is to give coverage to great work being done by Australians, and to perhaps highlight where things could be done a little better. But you're certainly doing a lot of things. So everyone out there, find out more. Simply go to the search engine, Thumbs Up Foundation, Jimmy Little Foundation, Good Tucker, Long
Thumbs
Life.
up, thumbs
Find out, yep,
up.org.au.
beautiful. Find
Sorry,
out how you can
it's
help.
thumbs up. You can find it thumbsup.org.au. Sorry.
Thumbsup.org.au. Wonderful. No worries. Now, Graham, a lot of people that knew you from a while. I mean, in fact, you're from Adelaide originally in Highgate, and I believe we were childhood neighbours.
Yes.
Now, you started your musician's
Yes.
life in Adelaide. Tell us a little bit about how you got started, because you've got a great new book coming up. Everyone, Buzz Bidstrop's new book coming up, No Secrets, which is being published by HarperCollins. Tell us a little bit about yourself and the book.
Okay, look, I started writing down some of my experiences because I have had kind of 60 years now of being involved in music in one way or another. And I started writing down a few things just for my family, basically, just to find out, if anyone in the future wanted to know, what did old, Graham do? What did he do? I just thought I'd write them down, And then I started showing a couple of bits and pieces that I'd written to some friends of mine, and they said, "That's really good. You should actually make it into a proper book. Don't just sell yourself short, So I started doing that, basically chronicling my time, and I started playing drums when I was about 13. Well, actually, a bit. Oh, I started hitting pots and pans and, that sort of stuff when I was about seven or eight. I was in a
Much to
school
your
band when
parents'
I was nine.
delight.
Oh, I used to get into all sorts of trouble. But played in the school drum and fife band at Highgate Primary. You sort of went through to I got to about 12. I was at Unley High School. I found a couple of other guys that, like playing music. We formed a little band that was a kind of a blues, we played blues music, which is, pretty much everyone did at the time.
What was that
And
band? What
of
was that
course with
band?
the Oh, that I think we at one stage we were called Simplicity Pattern. I don't know why. Another one was System of Sound. There were two bands that had pretty much the same members, and we used to rehearse at this hall, Mitcham Institute, and we'd rehearse there on a Sunday afternoon. And there was a band of older guys that used to rehearse after us. And one day we finished rehearsal, and this bass player of the other band came up and said, "Oh, look, our drummer can't make it today. Would you mind hanging around and just playing some drums with us so we could rehearse?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, that's cool, And I was 14, and those guys, this guy was 18, and the singer was 20, and they were all much older than me, but I said, "Yeah, okay, and I did that, and then the next week, they came up to me and said, "Would you do it again?" And I went, "Oh yeah, I guess so, and I did it again." And then they asked me if I wanted to be in their band, and they played a gig at that time. They were called Fahrenheit 451,
Yes,
and they.
actually, I remember hearing you practice because we used to walk past that hall, Graham. It was on
You're
Victoria
kidding.
Terrace, I think, opposite
Yeah.
the girls' tech school,
Yeah.
next to
Oh,
the
that the,
barbers.
the yeah that one yeah that was on that yeah that was a different band. I think that was the band before Fahrenheit. Oh, no, maybe it was. Gee, it's a long
I
time.
know.
But I remember the
There used
gig
to be
in
a
Mitcham.
sign up saying Fahrenheit 451 practicing or something, but
Oh,
you
okay,
remember
there
we,
you go, there, shameless promotion.
That's
But
right.
that band turned out to be quite a successful band. In fact, they would work 3 4 nights a week. Now, for a 15, well, at the time I was 14, I turned 15 in the year that I joined them, which was 67, and I was in third year high school and playing like 3 4 nights a week.
That'd be right, yeah.
Yeah.
No,
So
that's about the time.
it was kind
Now,
of.
so this actually sounds like a fantastic book out through HarperCollins, No Secrets by Graham Bidstrup, Buzz Bidstrup. What a history you've got, Graham. And of course, No Secrets, the title of a famous Angel song, which the band you played for.
Indeed, it was. It was a song I wrote with Doc Neeson, in 1979. It got released in 1980 and was our first top 10 hit. It was a great song. It sort of coincided with 1980 being my last year with the Angels. I left at the end of 1980. I played until the middle of 81. But yeah, I left and went on to do all sorts of other stuff. Did film music. I was in the Party Boys. I did sessions, people like Mondo Rock and Jimmy Barnes and Australian Crawl, Semantics, Reckless, all that kind of stuff. And the book really, goes through, I guess, that period of time. And I talk a bit about what it was like in the studios, what it was like playing, what, some of the things that people have, I guess, would be interested in knowing about, being the life of a musician and a producer, because I produced a lot of produced a lot of records as well.
Yeah, you've done
So
some great
yeah, it's
stuff. You've done some great stuff, Buzz. And if you want to read a fantastic book about life, what it's like to be a muso in Australia and write some great songs and play in some great bands, then get out and buy No Secrets, which is coming out through HarperCollins, the story and author, Graham Buzz Bidstrup. Graham, I think
It'll be in September, I should say. Wait,
we may have to do another ch chat just to talk more about your book. But thanks so much for being part of this and the radio show, speaking about the amazing work of the Jimmy Little Foundation and your involvement in that. And for the health of all Indigenous people, a big thumbs up to you, Graham. And also for news on your book,
Thank you.
No Secrets. We look forward to reading it.
Okay, I just should let people know that it's not until Father's Day, so September it's coming out. Is that so,
September. September. Yep. Get out
September
and
this
buy
year.
No Secrets.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. It's been lovely to talk to you, Greg, as
Thank you
always.
so much, Buzz. It's been an absolute pleasure.